Hello and welcome to this, our second day covering the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology Conference here in downtown LA. John and I had quite contrasting days today. John had to spend most of the morning in the British Embassy, having lost his passport. John. And was presenting a poster in the afternoon, whilst I, on the other hand, was treated to a media event in which all the background information was provided for me and all the relevant academics were all lined up ready and waiting for interviews. So, not too bad for me, eh? So, as for this episode, we've got some fantastic interviews from broken penis bones to climate change and evolution denialism. I hope you enjoy them. So I'm here with Anna Siach and Sami Churan from the University of Cape Town, and she's been looking at evidence of fungal interactions with bones of a Permian theraspid. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
So basically I work on bone microstructure. I'm usually very excited about looking at the good, well-preserved bones. But often in my work, I come across bones that are altered. And I found this animal that I was working on. It's a 260 million-year-old relative of mammals. And I found that its bones were altered. And I couldn't see any histological structure. So all the microstructure that normally you make was wonderful deductions about growth and about biology, they weren't preserved. And what I found was that in the channels where the blood vessels normally course through the bones, they were this dark matter, which you can't see anything. It's just like a big blob inside these channels. And I kind of looked at it under higher and higher magnification, and I found that these channels actually had these fine tubules that were sticking out from it. And this was just under light microscopy. So I decided, look, this obviously it reminded me of fungi, but I said, 260 million years old? I mean, you know, can it be? And so I began to investigate this more further. And I found out that, in fact, these are, in fact, traces of fungal attack on a bone. And what we were just so fortunate to see is that the bone wasn't completely destroyed, that the bone structure, if you look at the bone, you can pick it up, feel it, hold it, it looks like an ordinary bone. But I think if that process wasn't halted, the whole bone would have decayed.
So what was it in the lithology that stopped it? Do we know?
We don't know for sure, but obviously it could be many factors. It could be temperature, it could be moisture, it could be something in that environment change to stop the process. So if you look at the picture on the website, you'll see these like glassy structures that emanate from these darker channels. And those structures actually, under a polarized light microscope on a thin section, you will see this has a very interesting structure. What we have a birefringent, they look crystalline. And so I was so excited about this, I then put the specimen under an SEM. And under the scanning electron microscope, one can actually see even more details. And then it really crystallized that these are actually these structures that are formed as a byproduct of fungal metabolism of the bone. So bone actually is a calcium phosphate. And what happens is during decomposition, the fungi metabolizes the phosphates, and as a byproduct, it deposits calcite along the as it's actually penetrating through the bone. And what I found are these wonderful channels that you can see. And if you look on the website, you'll see these beautiful pictures that show you these tubular structures, which are all mineralized structures that are a byproduct of the calcium of the fungi metabolizing the bone.
Do you think we'd be able to see more of these structures in other bones now that we know to look for them so far back in history?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is 260 million years, but I know for sure that there are lots of other bones that have been altered. This is just one that I've investigated more because there were so many of them. I mean, I had like 17 thin sections, and all of them were from one individual, and they showed this phenomenal damage. But I think that if we begin to scrutinize the bone samples that we have, have, we will be able to recognize these structures. I think people just before are only interested in the good preservation, because the good preservation tells us so much about biology. And I mean, you know, I have two books written on bone microstructures, but I was excited by this particular alteration because I was able to understand what was the agent of decay for this particular individual.
So have we managed to find anything out about the fungi in particular? Is it related to anything that we can see nowadays?
That's a cool question, yes, because the fungi that we see, you know, fungi normally are very good agents of decomposition in modern environments. And in the modern world today, we know there's a genus called Muco that actually attacks bone. Now, I can't say for sure. I don't have any evidence to say this is a fungi called Muco, but it seems to look like it could be a member of the same genus, or it could be a different genus, but again, one that is able to metabolize bone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're with Faisal Bibi, who's been looking at the importance of the fossil record for molecular phylogenetics. Now, it sounds like quite a mouthful, so can you give us a brief summary of what your work's about?
Okay. In general, I think a lot of people today have heard about DNA, right? And that we all have genomes, and just all animals have genomes. And in recent years, with technological advances, we can look in sequence animal genomes. And what this means is that we have an additional tool for investigation of evolution, because whereas previously we would focus more on the anatomy of an organism, now we have that, plus we can also look at genomic similarities between between animals that are alive today and say something about how they're related and how they evolved in the past. And so what I'm doing as a paleontologist who works on ruminants, which are animals like antelopes, I know the fossil record well, and I'm trying to integrate that into all these new genomic studies that have been coming out that only focus on living animals and can overlook or perhaps are not aware of the huge amount of data that's available in the fossil record of these animals.
So when you're looking at DNA, do you have to just look at how different each strand is, and then once you've worked that out, how do you apply that to the fossil record?
Well, what's great is that a lot of DNA samples already exist, and when they get published, they're available. So anyone can actually go online and download DNA of a very a huge and growing number of animals out there. And what there are many different aspects one could look at, but what I was specifically looking at now was what's called molecular age estimation. And what that involves is that, quite independent of the fossil record, well, relatively, one can, looking at the amount of genetic differences between two species, one can estimate an age at which they diverged from a last common ancestor. So let's say, for example, Dave, you and I, someone comes in, looks at my genome, looks at your genome, and then sees the amount of differences between us. And if we have some sense about how human genomes change over time, you might be able to say how far long back you and I shared a grandfather, a grandparent of some kind. You can do the same thing going back millions of years with genomes. But what that requires is to calibrate the clock, the rate at which the genes change. That requires some knowledge of the fossil record. And so I was able to apply my knowledge of the fossils to produce what had not been done before, was that to produce a very tightly controlled clock, if you like, of molecular change. And then applying that to this massive genomic database that's available now produces an amazing large family tree of these animals that has dates attached to it going back 30, 40 million years in time.
So with this method, were you able to really nail down some of the divergence times of certain groups? And is that something new that we hadn't, those dates that we hadn't had before?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was able to provide new ideas about divergence times for some of the interesting groups. And with that, one can also find divergence times for things like big dispersal events, such as if we know a group evolved in Africa and then dispersed to Europe, then we might be able to say something about when and why, try to link that to climatic events. But really, all of that stuff will come later, because I think the first step is that when you get a molecular age is to go out and test it with the fossil record again in order to find really, because evolution, I mean, happened once, right? And so we're really after reconstructing that one story. And it's a matter of generating ideas that we can then test by going out and collecting more information. So what I've contributed are some new ideas about these divergence ages that themselves don't settle the big question, but have taken us several steps forward towards settling it by finding more and more fossils. And in fact, one could argue that in science, nothing's ever settled. We just always want more and more, better and better information about our past.
Faisal, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So now we're joined by Larissa DeSantis from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and she's been looking at university students' acceptance of climate change and evolution. So is there a link between climate change and evolution denial?
So that's exactly what we're trying to assess, is whether skeptics of evolution were also skeptics of climate change. And no one had really looked at this. They had always concentrated on one or the other. And what we essentially found is that how you responded to one statement, whether it be on evolution or climate change, actually predicted how you were going to respond to every single other statement that we surveyed students about. And so those who were less accepting of evolution were also less accepting of climate change.
Do we have any idea where that might be?
Yes, definitely. The strongest predictors were, not surprisingly, politics and religion. And so if you considered yourself a conservative Republican and or religious, you were less likely to accept both climate change and evolution. In contrast, if you considered yourself a liberal Democrat and or an atheist or agnostic, you are more accepting of climate change and evolution. There were a few other things that predicted acceptance if you're politically active, that also predicted acceptance, and further, what state you were educated in to some level. So one of the things that was really interesting is if you were from a red state based on our 2012 presidential election or from the southern region, you were more likely to be taught creationism in school and or intelligent design, and you were less likely to be accepting of evolution. In contrast, if you were from a blue state, you are more likely to be taught human evolution and more accepting of evolution. We didn't find correlations between teaching practices as far as creationism and evolution and climate change, but we did find that where you were educated, whether it was a red or blue state or what region, predicted your acceptance of evolution.
Okay, so from the scientific perspective, is this a problem with the education system in the U.S.?
It's hard to speak to that, but what these data do suggest is that a state's geographic region, if residing in the South or politically, or their political inclination, is a good proxy for biology teaching practices. And so, you know, science should be essentially based on the best peer-reviewed literature, and instead we're finding that acceptance of scientific theories is really based on belief systems and other things that have nothing to do with science, like politics and religion.
So for those of us that aren't from the US, is the national curriculum handed down from Washington, or is it each state gets to decide what they teach themselves?
It varies. Typically, they just passed what's called the Next Generation Science Standards, and it's up to the states to then adopt those standards, and this is actually currently happening. The Next Generation Science Standards do include quite a few standards on both evolution and climate change, and both of those topics are actually cross-cutting topics and go across multiple standards, and so there is hope, but one of the problems is that states can also pass anti-climate change, anti-evolution bills, and this recently happened in the state of Tennessee. Just in 2012, they passed a bill that encourages teachers to teach the scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of evolution, climate change and other topics like human cloning and the chemical origins of life. And so what that does is it encourages teachers to teach it as a debate when scientifically climate change and evolution are not being debated.
Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
So here in Los Angeles is a very famous Lagerstätte, which is a site of special preservation. And this is a Konzentrat Lagerstätte, which is one that's got a lot of individuals in it. And that's the La Brea tar pits, of course. And looking at the La Brea tar pits and others like it is Greg McDonald from the National Park Service. Greg, could you tell us a little bit about these kind of tar pits? How do they form?
Well, basically, wherever you got oil, you have the potential for a tar pit. And so if you look at where oil deposits are, and if you have any type of geological activity like faults that fracture the rock, the oil comes to the surface. Once it reaches the surface and spreads out, it starts becoming sticky in the sun. Animal steps on it. It's kind of like stepping on flypaper. Once you're there, you're kind of going to be there for a while. And when an animal steps on it, say a giant ground sloth or a mammoth or a camel or a horse or something like that, it makes it easy prey for predators. And so then you have things like saber-toothed cats, short-faced bears, North American lions that say, hey, there's a free meal. They come down, and there's no such thing as a free lunch. They get stuck and continues the cycle. And most of what we know about tar pits has come from the 100 years. We're actually celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first excavations at Rancho La Brea here in Los Angeles. But we now know that tar pits with animals and plants preserved in them are worldwide. We have them in South America, in Azerbaijan, in Eurasia. They've recently been found on the island of Cuba. And so we're now recognizing that getting these really rich Lagerstätten, well-preserved material where even the biomolecules are preserved because the bone is totally unaltered when it gets soaked with tar is a much more widespread phenomenon, not just a Southern California one.
So comparing all of these sites, do they all follow the same kind of rule? Herbivore gets trapped, predators come in after it?
Well, because Rancho La Brea is so well known, that's the first assumption people make. And what I'm basically saying is, let's step back, because we recognize that tar could be there not because it's entrapment, but that it came up after the bone bed or the animal was preserved, and it's really secondary. And so the idea is not to be so biased by the fact that there's tar present, but look at the other scientific data that's there that might tell us that something else happened and the tar wasn't the real reason why we got this fossil site preserved.
Okay, so you've mentioned two things now. One is the model of a predator trap, a few herbivores and a lot of carnivores. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you've mentioned is the preservation of the bones. Now, in these other sites, if the tar comes into the equation secondarily, can you see a statistical difference in the amount of herbivores to carnivores and also in the preservation of the bones?
Absolutely. A new site that's being excavated in Ecuador, no carnivores have been found yet. In fact, the common animal that they're getting out is a giant ground sloth. And if you start looking at the geology, it looks like this was actually a river channel, and these carcasses were caught up and buried maybe on a sandbar or something in a river channel, and then got buried, and then who knows whether hundreds or thousands of years later, with tectonic activity, earthquakes and that, the faults, the oil came up and secondarily saturated that layer and preserved it. And because of that, when you go in and you try to sample for the collagen to do a carbon 14 date or to look for biomolecules, they were already leached out because their tar was there long after this weathering process took place.
Is it just vertebrates you get in there? Are there any other animals or plants you can also get?
Well, at Rancho La Brea, you do. You get the plant material, you get insects, so you really get this phenomenal preservation of the whole biota. In the Ecuadorian site, all you get is the bone. We haven't gotten the plants, we haven't gotten the insects, and so you see a very significant difference with regards to what does get preserved. It's a much, much smaller subset. So that seems to be one of the things to look for when you're excavating. But it also means to make sure that it's not there and you just haven't missed it, you've got to really do fine level excavation, screen the material, and look for the small stuff and not just focus on the big bones.
So I work in the oil industry, and I've spent quite a lot of time out in the North Sea, and Saudi Arabia is the obvious place where mm-hmm. you do get a lot of oil. So in these places, I haven't heard of any kind of tar pit preservation. Why don't we get it there when we have so much oil?
That's the $64 question. When I look at a map of where oil reserves are in the world, I look at Saudi Arabia and say, they've got to be there. And it may be simply the fact that the focus is on other things. Oil geologists are looking at it from an economic standpoint. So a tar seep on the surface may be a good indicator of what's worth drilling for, but the fact that bones are in it may not be as high of interest to them. But this is one of these areas where I think there's real good chance for complementary work with regards to oil companies. If they're willing to work with the paleontologists to share the information, we can add to a really better understanding of the ecology of the area and the history of a particular region that tar pits provide that's unlike any other sites in the world. So I think the potential is there. It's just a matter of developing that collaboration.
Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure. Happy to do it.
So we've got here Ryan Haupt from the Science Sort Of podcast and also of the University of Wyoming. What have you been doing here today, Ryan?
Today I gave a talk during the La Brea Symposium about the survival of cougars through the late Pleistocene extinction in the North American continent.
So did quite a lot of things go extinct at that time?
Yeah, it was a big extinction. It's known as the megafaunal extinction. It's when we lost all of the, at least in North America, we lost all of the mammoths and the woolly rhinos and the mastodons and the ground sloths, which are a personal favorite of mine, as well as 4 out of 6 large cats in North America. So there were at least 6 different genera of large cats, and only 2, the modern mountain lion and the jaguar, are still alive today.
So what were they doing right that the rest were doing wrong?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the story, isn't it? We looked at their microware, and from their microware we can tell that they were consuming about as much bone in their diet as a modern African lion. So animals like cheetahs will eat just the meat, and they won't eat any of the bones. They don't like bones. Hyenas eat a ton of bones, and so you can kind of bracket the extremes of what's called durophagy, or hard object feeding. And that shows up in the microarray of their teeth, like the microscopic texture of what's going on with the tooth. And so when we look at mountain lions in the modern day, they look a lot like lions in Africa. But we know that modern mountain lions feed on a very wide range of diets. So up in Canada, a mountain lion will get big enough that it can take down a moose. But in parts of Central and South America, there are mountain lions that specialize just on hares, rabbits, and things that they could eat completely. They'll consume everything, bones and all. And so we see this kind of moderate signal where they're eating some bones, not exclusively bones like a hyena, but more than something like a cheetah. And so we used this modern understanding of cougar ecology to then go look in the fossil record, specifically at the La Brea tar pits here in California. And we compared the microware of cougars to other larger than cougar felids, the Panthera atrox, which is known as the American lion, and the Smilodon fatalis, or the saber-toothed cat, which is actually California's state fossil. States have fossils. Did they do that in the UK? Does Manchester have an official fossil?
No, but if it did, it'd be a chasmotaspidid, of course.
What's that?
What's that? It's like a Eurypterid. State fossil of New York.
Okay, yeah, I know Eurypterid. Yes. So we looked at those three felids and compared their microware. And what we found was that animals like the Panthera atrox, this American lion, which is a name I don't really like. It didn't even have a mane. Like, how is it? I mean, I don't know. I know only the males have manes, but it's not my favorite term for the animal. But the American lion actually doesn't look like an African lion when you're looking at its microware. It looks more like a cheetah. It looks like it's avoiding bone. Smilodon also looks like it's avoiding bone. It's eating a bit more bone than the American lion, but not a lot. Not even at a modern lion level of bone consumption. And we think what's going on there is that these American lions and saber-toothed cats were so big and ferocious that they could bring down mega herbivores. So they could bring down a large ground sloth or something like that. And if you bring down something that big and you're a single solitary individual, you can eat a lot of that meat and get enough food and not have to eat any bones. The bones are unnecessary. And so we found that the pumas living in La Brea around the time of the late Pleistocene extinction were eating a lot more bone than either of those two other cats. And what we think that that means, and they were eating about the same amount of bone as modern cougars would eat today. So they're basically doing the same thing now that they were doing back in the Pleistocene. And whatever they were doing in the Pleistocene seems to have worked because they survived. So what we think that that means is that cougars were eating smaller animals because that would reduce the level of competition with these other large carnivores. So if you think back to this African analog, a cheetah will bring down a gazelle, and a lot of times that will get stolen by a leopard or a lion or a hyena because there are a lot of other predators who would take a free meal if a cheetah brings it down for them. And so if you can think of that in terms of the Pleistocene, these cougars, if you bring down a rabbit, you're not leaving a lot of food left over for another carnivore to come steal it from you. And you're going to eat the whole thing, so you're going to get that durophagy signal because you're going to be seeing the bones that cougar is consuming. And we kind of see the same interplay happening in places like South America, where a cougar will bring down a large animal like a guanaco, which is a 200-plus pound camelid, looks kind of like a llama. And they'll bring down these big guanacos and immediately get chased off by condors. These Andean condors will swoop down and scare off the puma, and then the condors will eat the guanaco that the puma just killed. And that, shows just how real competition can be amongst these carnivores. But if a cougar kills something like a rabbit, they can eat it quickly enough that nothing's going to be able to steal it from them. So it seems like this generalist dietary strategy of just eating whatever they can get their hands on and eating a lot of smaller stuff, because the, mega herbivores went extinct too. So it's possible that these Smilodons and these Panthera atrox, because they were relying on these really big herbivores, when those herbivores were gone, they couldn't cope with eating smaller animals. But the puma was already doing that, so it was able to get through the Pleistocene extinction, and survive until today.
When I was in Colorado doing my independent mapping when I was a student, I got chased by a mountain lion.
Okay. What happened? Tell me the whole story.
Well, I got chasing. Away.
Well, how was it chasing you?
It was stalking me.
Stalking you?
Yeah.
From above, or?
From the same level. It was in...
Interesting.
We were in a riverbed, and okay. It was coming through the grasses behind us, and just walked away. Didn't run.
You walked away?
I walked away.
Did you turn your back to it?
I can't remember.
You're not supposed to turn your back.
I don't know if it did. I have no idea. Can't remember. Well, all I remember was that I was scared.
A lot of mountains like to attack from above, so they like to drop down on the prey. They've actually found kill sites where it was a mule deer that was taken out, and it was taken out by a mountain lion, and there weren't even any bite marks. And what looked like it had happened was the mountain lion dropped it down on this deer from such a height that it broke the deer's neck and didn't have to actually bite it to kill it. So they're pretty fierce.
So my question is, if it had gotten me, what would it have done?
A lot of cats will try to bite the back of the neck and get their canines to pierce the spinal cord. So there's this amazing video that National Geographic put out a few weeks ago of a jaguar in South America going after a caiman, so like this tiny alligator crocodile thing. And the jaguar actually comes out of the water and gets the caiman. It's like a total role reversal. You always see the crocodiles grabbing the things while they're getting a drink. But this caiman's out on the shoreline of the river sunning itself. And this jaguar swims across the river and pounces. And you can see it jump on the caiman. The caiman reacts and struggles. But the jaguar just bites down on the back of the neck. And almost immediately the caiman stops struggling because it punctured the spinal cord and the thing couldn't move. So that's what they like to do because, you don't want to deal with your meal struggling too much. So the quicker you can subdue it and get it to stop fighting you, the better off your meal's going to be.
And for science, sort of, are you doing anything here for that?
I'm not really. I use this to make contacts and to meet people. For those who don't know, Science Sort of is a podcast that I do where we drink beer and talk about science. It's a lot of fun. And I've been wanting to get you and John on Science Sort of for a while, and now I get to meet you, so this is SVP's doing its job. I have a mic. It's not nearly as fancy, so I'm embarrassed to bring it out, but I might bug you about it later. So, yeah, how's SVP going for PaleoCast?
It's going pretty good. We're members of the media here, so we get special... I don't know how you'd call it. They say press speed dating, where you go around and you have an allocated time with a researcher, and that's worked out pretty well. But we kind of like just going around, looking at the posters, and just talking to people, just straight up, and seeing what they're doing.
Yeah, this is my first time not doing a poster. This is my first talk at SVP, and I feel like it went pretty well. It's nerve-wracking. It's like an intense crowd of people. I mean, it's a lot of really smart people watching your science and judging you. You know, not in a mean way, but they're judging you because that's what we're trained to do as scientists, and it gets intimidating.
Yeah, so at GSA, where we were just at, there were so many more people, but there were so many talks that each individual room you'd have, maybe 100 people, but in SVP we've got 3 or 4 rooms, and each one's got about 500 chairs, possibly?
Yeah, and most of the talks I've been to have a crowd in them. They're not, you know, it's not a smattering. You got a full complement of paleontologists watching your work.
Of experts, yeah.
Exactly. It's intimidating. So what do I got to do to make you not hate pumas again? Because they're really cool.
I'm an arthropod worker now. That time has passed.
Okay, so it's over for you.
You just can't go back.
I guess not.
If there was a fight between a puma and a pterygoated Eurypterid,
you think the Eurypterid would have it?
I don't know, probably not. But I'm not going to put that out.
yeah, no, definitely. Well, I guess we got to find an insectivorous cat, and then we can work on that together.
Oh, great. Well, so the arthropods are getting eaten again.
I mean, it's kind of the common theme. There's not a lot of arthropods eating mammals out there, so the odds of us finding the cat-eating spider are I feel like, smaller than finding the spider-eating cat.
Well, I'll look forward to that episode then.
Sounds good, man. Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. This was a lot of fun.
Well, I appreciate you being on.
Thanks
very much. Adam Hartstone Rose of the University of South Carolina School of Medicine has brought a poster called Extraordinary Penises, the Bacula of Rancho La Brea. So, penises in La Brea. Can you talk us through them?
Yeah, so people are often surprised to learn that that penises have bones. And of course, in humans, they don't. But actually, in most mammals, or an awful lot of them at least, they do have bones, and sometimes they're fairly substantial bones. And they're often quite ignored, even though they're fascinating. So things like the lowly raccoon has a really fascinating baculum, a kind of a curved, amazing thing. In the United States, they call those mountain man toothpicks because, you know, you could use them to sort of squeegee out some of the stuff in the teeth. But anyway, I became interested in sort of these understudied bones at Rancho La Brea. Of course, Rancho La Brea is a very famous site, probably the best site for carnivore paleontology that there is in the world, some would argue, and I would agree with that. But certain bones have been understudied. So last year we published a paper on the clavicles, the collarbones of the saber-toothed cats and those guys. So the next weird bone on the list that I wanted to tackle was the baculum. And the remarkable thing is that so many people have been taking me seriously at this meeting. But in fact, a lot of people have been interested in these bacula. So the baculum, of course, is the penis bone. And it turns out that there are many of them at Rancho La Brea. The collection at the Page Museum, unfortunately, there are only a few of these little guys. So there's one fox baculum, one baculum of a badger, which is impressive because the end of it is kind of like corkscrew shaped, which, as you can imagine, is amazing. Then there's this little baculum of a weasel here. And what's impressive about the weasel baculum is that it's roughly the size of his femur. So his baculum is as long as his thigh, which is pretty cool. And then there are about 18 of these coyote bacula. But all of those are really very similar to the modern species. Nothing too cool about them. But what's amazing is that there are 400 bacula of dire wolves, these sort of big, robust wolves that we find in the fossil record there. And 218 of them were substantial enough that we could measure. They were complete enough that we could measure. And we found that there is an ontogenetic scale, so we can tell, we think, juveniles from sort of the alpha dogs of the group. And so we took a bunch of measurements from them, and we found that they are the most different bone relative to gray wolves. So in most respects, gray wolves and dire wolves are actually hard to tell apart. Dire wolves are generally bigger than most gray wolves, but there's a lot of overlap, and some subspecies of modern wolves are actually bigger than these extinct, what we think of as giant wolves, essentially. But with the baculum, it's night and day. You can tell them apart really easily, actually. The dire wolf has an extraordinary baculum. It's about 30% longer. And in terms of a volumetric proxy, so a proxy on sort of the size of the thing, it's over 200% as big as a gray wolf. So a dire wolf was quite an impressive fellow. And in fact, when we first set out, so the published title of this is actually we were trying to look at the broken and rehealed bacula, because indeed you see broken bones, broken penis bones quite often in my own research collection.
Are you saying in your own?
No. I have never broken my penis. But in my research collection back at the university, I have about a dozen raccoon bacula that have been broken and rehealed. And in fact, I have a few that have been broken twice and rehealed. And we've actually found in La Brea a few of these bones that have been broken. And so this one here has been broken and is and rehealed about 20 degrees off axis. So, you know, he was a little bit crooked after that. But in fact, it's actually fairly rare in the collection. So only about 8 of the more than 400 have been broken and healed. Whereas in other bones and teeth and parts of the skeleton, we find much more damage to dire wolves than in most other populations. So they were breaking their legs, but they weren't breaking their penises as much as we thought that they would. And I think that what's happening is the reason that they're so much more substantial than modern wolves is that maybe they became more robust in order to sort of resist sort of that tough space that La Brea was. And so, indeed, for these guys, probably size did matter.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.